Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 140. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, we're looking at a couple of films noir. I have my friend Armin from Germany on the line, who donated to the Patreon campaign, and he and I are going to be having a chat about a 1948/1949 movie, Reign of Terror, also known as The Black Book, directed by Anthony Mann and starring Robert Cumming and Richard Basehart. And then we go into one of the classics of film noir, Crisscross, from 1949, directed by Robert Siodmak, starring Burt Lancaster and Yvonne DiCarlo and Dan Duryea. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. Hi, Armin, how are you doing?
Hi, Terry, I'm fine. I'm happy to be on the show. Thanks.
Yeah, we started the recording a little while ago, and then the wheels fell off it, so we had to start again. So just introduce yourself to the people. Tell them why you like movies, just like you did about 10 minutes ago.
No problem. I can be a bit more concise this time. So, as most of the movie fans on Facebook and other groups, I think I'm pretty much first learned about movie when sneaking out as a child while my parents were asleep and trying to watch the late horror movies from Hammer and so forth, and really already imagined that there's such a great world beyond ordinary life and such a magic in cinema that I really fell in love from the first time. And now only recently try to understand more of the mechanics and the creation of this magic that we see in movies.
So you mentioned a little bit that you kind of snuck out to watch movies when you were very young. What kind of movies were you sneaking out to watch?
I have vivid memories of actually film noirs that I always liked but never really understood in depth. I was just fascinated by the fact that in some of these movies the bad guy got away in the end, or there were really ruthless people which were not brought to justice, as I've seen in so many TV series, like in westerns and crime TV series, which always ended with a happy ending and justice was served and so forth. And one of the first really horrific memories kind of was I think Dracula AD 1972 with Christopher Lee. I think the last one won Hammer Christopher Lee, and I still vividly remember this horrible impaling at the end. And when I snuck back into bed, I was maybe, I don't know how old I was exactly, but maybe 9 or so, and then I was right. So afraid of Dracula getting to me, and I took two pencils and created a cross and hid under my blankets and waited until the morning came.
That reminds me of me doing that. I snuck out to watch late night horror movies when I was a kid, and I saw a thing called The Hypnotic Eye, which starts out with a woman who's washing her hair, shampooing her hair, and for some reason she puts something inflammable on her hair and then leans over a gas jet and sets her hair on fire. And I found that really terrifying. The special effect of that happening now, I've seen the movie recently, is woefully bad, but at the time it was terrifying.
Sounds great. I have to see it.
Yeah. Yep, The Hypnotic Eye. I recommend people show that to their children. apart from film noir, what are your main loves as far as movies are concerned? Are you into crimmy movies or anything like that?
I like definitely the old black and white stuff. This wave of the movies from Germany also. But I think my main movie love is maybe horror. In horror. But now, of course, I'm trying to evolve a bit as a watcher. And to be honest, one part of my list is actually one thing I tried out, and I was highly positively surprised going into the more artful movies, watching Wes Anderson's Grand Budapest Hotel, and I was really, really blown away. So I will now try to go more into the more artistic filmmaking. But my starting point was always horror, and I still will also defend horror till my death and really watch nearly everything that comes out, even the very cheap stuff. But I try to watch a lot of stuff, even things. I try to force myself sometimes into things I possibly don't think are worthy in the beginning, but sometimes I'm really positively surprised.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So I believe you've been watching some blaxploitation movies lately.
Yes. Just to quickly get back to the list, I basically watched Black Caesar, Three the Hard Way, and Slaughter, which I all found really entertaining, but would possibly rank Black Caesar best regarding the story, the acting, and the whole drama, the whole depth of the movie, but all were quite entertaining, and I definitely try to watch more blaxploitation movies in the near future.
Yeah, I was just thinking, Fred Williams, much better actor than he was ever given credit for.
Yeah, absolutely. So he's really good, and also, I mean, I was really blown away by the without spoiling too much, by the end scenes of especially Black Caesar. So there's not just the bad guy with a cigar and a gun, but also shows some emotional depth when he is confronting the main bad guy in the end with his shoeshine box. It's really powerful stuff, I thought. And he also good script and everything.
Yeah, a bit of Larry Cohen there, but yes. Yeah, I'm gonna have to watch Three the Hard Way again. I haven't seen that in a long time, and I think it's a little hard to find a decent print of it online. But I think I'm gonna have to go to Three the Hard Way. So, anything else you've been watching that's of interest?
Yes, I watched. Not so much of general interest, but I definitely wanted to watch the second Exterminator movie, which I did recently. And was not positively surprised, but it was just a movie nerd thing. I had to watch the second part because of the open end of the first part, and it's way below the quality of the first part, which is also not a super great movie, but has this nice New York 70s, 80s griminess, and this broken hero, and amazingly cheap effects, which are funny. There's, I think, a head chop-off scene in the first movie in a Vietnam flashback, which is just to be seen to be believed. It's really amazing, amazingly bad. But Exterminator 2 is just, it's a cheapo movie, but I like Robert Ginty, and I also actually like the main replacement for his buddy in the first movie, who dies in the first movie. It's, I think, Frankie Faison. It's the guy who plays Hannibal's prison guard. So it's this African-American guy. He plays a truck driver, or actually a garbage truck driver, which is the comical relief of the movie, so to say.
Cool. I'm really going to have to revisit. I did watch the Exterminator movies, I think, on VHS back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was just renting things by the ton at that stage and watching pretty much anything that came out. But anything else you want to mention, or is that your list at the moment?
Yes, I would say one of the things I... I forgot to mention in my list of favorite genres, so to say, or movie types, is, of course, Asian cinema. So I try to understand more about Asian cinema, not just Japanese, but also the Korean output of the last couple of years. And I watched The Suspect, which is a Korean kind of spy movie with undercover North Korean agents in South Korea. And that's really just a good action thriller movie. I would say not at the level of Old Boy or others, but really entertaining flick. Then I watched...
I'm writing that down. I'm writing down Suspect. So, yeah.
I think it's officially just called either Suspect or the Suspect. So it's not a bad... Of course, what I always liked, that the level of production of these South Korean movies is always astonishing. The action scenes are great. And this guy, I would say, gives Tom Cruise as an agent in Mission Impossible a run for his money. So he's really it's just a lean and believable, realistic, badass agent guy, really, with his fists and guns and knives and everything. There's great car stunts, climbing scenes and everything. It's really, really interesting. Also the whole North Korea versus South Korea angle.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to get the copy of that one and watch it.
My high point, maybe just watching watch it last week, is Grand Budapest Hotel, which is a masterpiece in my view. And I would say I always was a fan of Ralph Fiennes, but this one is really Oscar-worthy performance. So really, his Gustav is really, it's an amazing character. It's really this great balance between cultured, likable, and interesting, but also in a way. Yeah, I would not say shit heel, but really like a lover boy that has this elderly ladies that really pay him in a way. So he's like a gigolo for these very old rich ladies.
A bit like Zero Mostel in The Producers.
Yeah, maybe. But did you see Grand Budapest Hotel, Terry?
I have it on a hard drive, but I haven't had time to watch it yet because I've been I'll talk about what I've been watching, and I'll explain the reason why I haven't got to Grand Budapest Hotel.
So just to finish up, I have watched last two flicks. I watched Out of the Furnace recently, which was a late watch, but I only got it now. Interesting thing here, I live very close to the border of the Netherlands, so I get, of course, many of the movies that are not yet released in Germany in just the media market, just the electronic market in Maastricht in Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they also have actually movies that are actually forbidden here in Germany because of, understandably, of our past, like exploitation stuff like Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS would be, of course, highly forbidden over here. But you can get it just over there very openly. And, of course, they have the swastika on the cover.
So you're publicly admitting that you smuggle movies into your country?
Of course. Always. All the time. But not drugs, just so, movies.
And so you should, too. I'm very proud of you for smuggling movies.
Out of the Furnace is, I found was really, what actually many people in other podcasts said and on Facebook, it's really well acted, but it's, the story is a bit too predictable, I would say, but still through the high level of acting by Bale and Affleck and especially Woody Harrelson is just a overall good drama. And I like many of the scenes, and I like also Bale's acting, which was a bit late, taken back, but really, really emotional, and really, I really felt for the characters. And last watch, again, as you see, there's a pattern here. It's always a mix between a bit higher and lower movies, I would say. It's Beyond the Law with Charlie Sheen, which is a really silly, I would say, 90s biker flick, where he goes undercover into a biker gang with Michael Madsen.
Okay.
And it's just entertaining because it has actually, and that's might be interesting for some people, it has, of course, as many movies from the era, a montage, or a couple of montage scenes. And there's actually a motorcycle building montage where he and the guy who introduces him, they build a motorcycle from the frame to the final finished cycle. It's really great stuff.
Okay, yeah, that's got to be a little bit different from a kind of action montage in a 1980s, 1990s movie, building a motorcycle. It's like the barn raising in Witness or something.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, so what I've been watching, I did for the Martian Drive-In podcast, part of the Patreon campaign was that I said if somebody donated a lot of money, I would review the three Star Wars movies, which I detest. Okay. And my friend Jane instantly gave me the money and said, ha ha, now you have to do it. So I fought my way through Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi. And I did put them into the last Martian Drive-In podcast, but it drained me to kind of talk about movies that I don't like very much at all. So I kind of found it a bit enervating to do that. Now, for the radio gig, I did two interesting movies lately. I did Curse of the Demon, which is the one with Dana Andrews, and Niall McGuinness, which was fantastic. Both of us sort of enjoyed it. The person I did it with, her name is, I've totally gone blank. It was a substitute person doing it. And Emma Haskin. Mm-hmm. She gets scared by horror movies. So even a movie like Curse of the Demon, which has those Jacques Tourneur jump cuts with things suddenly jump into the frame from out the side, scared her a lot. So she enjoyed it, but she found it very scary. And the week before, Liz Travaskis, who's the main person I do the radio thing in the ABC in the Northern Territory of Australia, we did Splice, the Vincenzo Natali science fiction movie about genetic engineering, which I'm going to do on a future podcast because I really want to get a couple of people. I know I've got a couple of people lined up to do it. But it's a really good movie about genetic engineering, which takes a very dark left-hand turn toward the end of it. So watch that. I recommend it, but you might maybe wait for the podcast and you can watch it just before or just after. It'll be in about three podcasts from now. And I did another Vincenzo Natali movie, which I'm halfway through, called Haunter, which is a little bit like that Nicole Kidman movie from a few years ago where they were ghosts. The whole family were ghosts. The others, yeah. It's a little bit like that, but it goes in a very different direction with it. And I liked Vincenzo Natali as a director, so I've got that kind of on hold at the moment.
He did Cube, right?
He did Cube, yeah. He did Cube and Cypher as well. So, and another thing, a movie called Nothing, which is very hard to find online, because if you type Nothing into a search engine, you're not going to get much there. But an interesting director, and I think he's doing some interesting things. But I saw the second of the new Spider-Man movies as well, which I can't really recommend. It's just all sound and fury signifying nothing. The characters aren't engaging. The villain, there's too many villains. There's too many plot points crammed into this thing, and it doesn't have the heart that a lot of other superhero movies managed to have.
Too bad. Really, the trailer looked messy. The trailer looked already really messy. Too much.
It's all over the place. There's like three different villains, one of whom doesn't get much to do. There's a lot of relationship stuff between Spider-Man and his girlfriend, and there's stuff with his auntie, played by Sally Field. And it's just like the script needed about three or four rewrites before it was where it should have been.
So
I can't really recommend that. And I did see something very silly, which was surprisingly good, which was Noah, the movie with Russell Crowe and Ray Winston in it. I think it's Aaron Aronofsky who directed it.
Yeah.
And he sets up this really weird universe where he treats the Bible the way people treat Greek mythology in Clash of the Titans.
Okay.
With that same kind of distance. And he sets up a kind of pre-deluge world where we have some different animals there, where everybody lives for hundreds of years, where there are different, even the chemical structure of elements in the earth are a bit different. And he kind of sets that up really nicely. It ends up being a fight between Ray Winston and Russell Crowe. But he does set up a very different look for it. And even though it's not perfect in any way, visually it's striking. And they actually have thought it through. And I like the idea of treating the Bible the way you treat a Greek mythology thing. It's like almost like Jason and the Argonauts for the Bible.
Okay, so it's a fantasy Bible, kind of.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a fantasy Bible kind of thing. And
are there dinosaurs on the Ark? No, just...
Well, no, there weren't dinosaurs, but there are some animals. There are things with... They're like wolves with armadillo scales. And the reason they don't survive, and this is a tiny spoiler, is all the animals go in the Ark and they're put to sleep with some gas, some smoke or something that Russell Crowe gets given by God. And Ray Winston hides out on the Ark. And... He's a carnivore, so he eats some of the animals. That's why the animals didn't survive till modern times, is Ray Winston ate them.
That's great.
Yes, I know. It's a very funny bit. So I watched that, and I enjoyed that a lot more than I did the Spider-Man thing. Let's see. I saw Sharky's Machine, a Burt Reynolds action film from 1980s, which has a really
Rachel
good
Ward,
jazz...
Right?
Yeah. Rachel Ward, who's now an Australian... And she's married to Brian Brown, and it's got a good jazz soundtrack, and it's not a bad little action film.
And Henry Silver is the bad guy, right?
Henry Silver's one of the bad guys. Vittorio Gassman's another bad guy in there. Yeah. They've got Brian Keith in there. Bernie Casey's in it. It's got a really nice ensemble cast in there, and even though it does steal a lot from the old film noir Laura, there's a plot point that.
Stolen from that.
I think, and the ending's a little bit truncated. After the bad guy dies, they could have given a few more minutes to tying up things, but they chose not to, and instead did a big helicopter shot over Georgia. But apart from that, it's not a bad little action flick from the 1980s.
And there's a weird torture scene I still remember from the movie with some Chinese henchman cutting off his fingers or something. It's really tense.
Yeah, Burt Reynolds loses two fingers in the movie, but gets Rachel Ward. She's at least two on the finger scale. So I saw that. I did see Snowpiercer, the Korean movie with the American actors in it. Science fiction set on an enormous train after an ice age where the survivors of the human race are endlessly traveling around the world on this train, and there are the poor and oppressed people at the back, and there are the rich and comfortable people at the front. It's all pretty much an analogy for the way modern society works on a global scale. Yeah. Capitalism and the exploitation of the underclasses and all that kind of stuff. But it's a good film, and I did like it, yeah. I think Chris Evans does a really good job in it. It's got John Hurt in it. Ed Harris is in it. And a bunch of other people. And I think it does work. It's got the usual kind of obsessions with amputation that are in a lot of Korean movies.
Oh, yeah.
But it's worth seeing. You can't take the science of it seriously because it's not actually about the science.
Yeah,
but class struggle and the analogies. There are some very severe analogies with capitalism and the way it exploits people in far distant places. So it's definitely worth checking out. So I do recommend that people see that one. It may not be on my list of top movies of the year, but I think it's an honourable effort. It really does deliver the goods in a lot of ways, even if you can't take all of it strictly seriously in an objective reality like we have.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed that. I did see Seth MacFarlane's comedy, A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Okay.
Seth MacFarlane, who does Family Guy. And it's got some funny moments in it. It's got a pretty good cast. Charlize Theron's in it. Liam Neeson's the bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Good.
It's got Giovanni Ribisi and Sarah Silverman in it. And it takes a lot of the tropes of Western movies and just makes fun with them. Like, they've got a great establishing shot right at the start, which could have come out of a Leone Western or something, where they do a slow, loving CinemaScope helicopter shots over Monument Valley to set the thing up, even though it's a comedy. And they do know what a good Western is. It's not rolling over laughing funny. There's a lot of gross-out humor in it and a lot of shit jokes and fucking jokes and all sorts of things like that. But
yes, of course.
It's a little bit of fun, and there's a plot twist in there as well. And the secondary characters are all a lot of fun. It's very much in the same kind of style as Family Guy, but done with real... Yeah, you know, in a reality thing rather than an animation thing. So it's one of those things you might want to watch it with a few friends and a few beers rather than watching it by yourself I do. Yeah. Yeah, I did see a horror movie too, so you might like this. I went over to a friend's place last night and we had dinner. They have a new rotisserie grill on their barbecue, so we cooked up some pork and some chicken on that. Knocked up some salads and watched a movie from about 2005 called Feast, horror film where a bunch of monsters, a bunch of monsters attack a bar. It's a low budget one. It was one of the Project Greenlight. Yeah. So I haven't seen 2 and 3 yet. They promised me they're going to let me watch 2 and 3 at some stage in the future. But yeah, there's lots of gross out humor in there. There's maggots, there's amputations, there's little monsters, there's big monsters, there's monsters fucking in the car park. It's got everything you need in a
puking scene, right?
Yeah, they got a very good monster puking scene. Yeah, they got a great monster puking scene where, and you never really do get a clear picture of the monsters that much because it's fairly low budget and there were limitations on it.
Yeah.
But it's a good, honest little horror film. It's a little bit of fun for people. And
it's fun. It's really fun.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, we were sitting back and we'd had a couple of beers and we'd stuffed ourselves full of very good food, so it was the right mood to watch that sort of thing. Yeah, but that's pretty much what I've been watching.
I love the characters. I love Clu Gulager as the barman and so forth. Yeah.
It's great. Judah Friedlander in there as well and a few other people. Clu Gulager. And you never knew who was going to get killed. They have those little things at the start where they tell you who the character is.
I love the hero entering the scene. Hero,
and the kid and the prostitutes and the woman who's going to rob the place and all that kind of thing. And nobody's life plays out the way it says in those little title cards. So it plays against expectations nicely, but while not being like an A-grade movie, it's an honest little horror film. So that's pretty much what I've been watching. I think we'll take a tiny little break now. When we get back, we'll start talking about Revolutionary France and Reign of Terror, directed by Anthony Mann.
They say the world doesn't have heroes anymore? Well, damn them, Max. You and me, we're going to give them back their heroes. Hi, this is Fifi McAfee from Mad Max, and you are listening to Paleo Cinema. Enjoy.
July 26, 1794. Anarchy, misery, murder, arson, fear. These are the weapons of dictatorship. Maximilian Robespierre, a fanatic with Taoisted mind. Saint-Just, connoisseur of roses and blood. Boucher the politician, always on both sides, never in the middle. Danton the soldier, savior of France. Francois Barras, citizen of the Republic. An honest man fighting for the life of his country. Callien, another honest man. In 48 hours, France will have a dictatorship.
And that was the bit at the start of Reign of Terror, also known as The Black Book, a 1949 American drama film directed by Anthony Mann. It stars Robert Cummings, Richard Basehart, and Arlene Dahl. It's set in France during the French Revolution. Plotters seek to bring down Maximilian Robespierre and end his bloody reign of terror. So why did you bring this one to me, Owen?
First of all, because I only recently found it, and I was really amazed that it never came to my attention before. Maybe because it's a bit older, and maybe because I did not know the main actors too well. I think the only one that really stuck out to me was possibly Basehart, but Cummings I just know from I think Sabotage, from the Hitchcock movie. But all the other ones were kind of new to me. And, of course, I like this interesting combination of historical drama and potentially noirish elements. Or it can be discussed if this is really a film noir, as you already pointed out in the beginning. But I found a really great combination of things. And I found also it features some very interesting like filming elements. So, therefore, we can discuss about not only the content. And I thought also the story was a bit more layered than you usually have. And actually, I had to watch it twice to really fully grasp all the details of the story, because possibly I didn't pay too much attention in the first watching, and therefore I didn't fully understand all the turns and twists of the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's beautiful. A fairly low-budget film directed by Anthony Mann. The producer was William Cameron Menzies, who I think directed Things to Come in 1936 based on the H.G. Wells story. And it's got one of the great film noir cinematographers, John Alton, who brings that beautiful chiaroscuro black and white photography to this film. And it lifts it enormously. This film may not be as good, it wouldn't have been as good as it was if not for John Alton in there. But the actors they've got in here are really great. Apparently most of them were New York stage actors. You've got Robert Cummings, who was in Saboteur with Hitchcock. And you've got another actor who
was
in Saboteur. Yeah, that's okay. And you've got Norman Lloyd, who played the bad guy in Saboteur, the one who hangs off the Statue of Liberty. He's in there as well, playing one of the characters in this film. The best acting in there, I think, Richard Basehart is good as Robespierre, and I'll play a little clip of him a little bit later. But Fouché, played by Arnold Moss, the chief of the secret police.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
He steals the movie, doesn't he? He's got that kind of ratty wig on. He's got quite a bold-looking face and a beautifully resonant voice. And he's playing both sides against the middle. And, he's only loyal where it suits his purposes.
Welcome to Paris, Citizen Duval.
It's a pleasure.
I never shake hands. It's unsanitary.
Why don't you eat your bun?
Good.
Delicious.
Remove the body. The people of Paris are becoming more stubborn every day.
It's becoming monotonous.
We'll do our very best to make it exciting for you here.
Fouché, why don't you take a walk? Well, the streets aren't safe this hour of the night. Oh, well.
Didn't you think he looks amazingly similar to, Adrian Brody? Like he could be his grandfather or something with a nose and everything?
Yeah,
so with a touch
be,
of Marty Feldman, maybe. So yes, that's great.
Yeah.
It's really a great look, but yes, this great voice, what you mentioned, really a booming, deep voice and this great middle-of-the-road position. So it's an amazing character. Really makes the movie also for me.
Yeah, I think they used a lot of scenes left over from the Joan of Arc they did with Ingrid Bergman. So a lot of the sets were left over from that for the film. And there's that bit where in silhouette, people are riding horses up a hill towards the windmill. And the windmill's just a hanging model in front of the hill. So because they do it in shadow, it's realistic. Yeah. But it's actually a hanging model, so they didn't have money to make a windmill. So, and it gives it a kind of abstract look at times. And John Alton, is marvellous in this film. There are so many layers to this film. There's Base Heart, there's the political stuff between Robert Cummings playing Charles d'Aubigny, who's pretending to be the butcher of Strasbourg, who's come to Paris to help Robespierre find the Black Book, which has got all the people that Robespierre, when he finally becomes dictator of France, is going to kill. This movie, I'm a bit confused that I didn't know it before now, because even though it doesn't have a lot of the same plot points as a film noir, it's filmed as a film noir. It's got the deep shadows, it's got the treachery and the deception parts, it's got people's in a really good depth of field as well. There are people in the foreground with stuff going on in the background. I don't know whether they use split diopter lenses or how they did it. But, this movie, people should see it. It's not a big movie. It doesn't have any really enormous stars. It's got Base Heart at his... I mean, Base Heart was always an actor who was incredibly tightly wound. He was very kind of... There's a lot of tension in anything he did. Even when he was doing Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, he was always playing angry, in a sense. He was never an actor that was going to be doing light comedies. And in this one, he's really repressed. He's got the high-collar tight suit on as Robespierre. He's got the attitude. He doesn't like women.
He doesn't like women, but he likes dogs, like dogs and pigeons, I guess. So there are two scenes with animals, or a couple of scenes with animals where he feeds them and stuff. Yes.
Yeah, dogs and pigeons.
What do you think of the...
No, please.
What do you think of the beginning, which I found a bit weird, this kind of newsreel type of introduction to the characters, when you see an extreme close-up of the faces and the flames and the terror in the background, and you got this voice from the off that explains, oh, this is Robespierre, he's a madman who tries to gain dictatorship. And so this I found really peculiar. I'm not really sure. Was it effect of the time? Because just after the end of the Second World War, where people were still used to this specific kind of newsreel type of information display, right? So I never saw it in another movie from the era.
No, it's a really odd device that they use. I don't know whether they made the film and then decided that people wouldn't know who the characters were without a bit of a cheat sheet up the front. They actually got Norman Lloyd to do the voiceover. He's doing a bit of a different voice there, but Norman Lloyd does that voiceover at the start of the film, where you introduce all the characters, you introduce their part in the story of the film. But it does lend a real weird sense of urgency about it. It's a bit like the voiceovers they used to do in the old TV series The Untouchables, right at the start, where you'd tell the voiceover from Walter Winchell would tell you who the criminals were and things like that. But, it is an odd device, and I don't know whether it works well to take you into the film or it startles you enough to pay attention. But one way or the other, I think...
It's a bit mixed for me, I think, because especially the interesting role of Fouché as a middle-of-the-road guy who betrays possibly both sides, and you're really not sure, is it a totally bad guy, like, for instance, Saint-Just, who's one of the main bad guys, who's really ruthless and threatening children and so forth and torturing people, or if he's more tending towards the good side. So I would find it technically a bit more interesting if they leave this out, if they not directly explain, oh, this guy is actually potentially dealing with everybody. So therefore I found it a bit weird. But on the other hand, maybe it's really, like you said, that you have a couple of layers of bad or partially bad guys, and they wanted to explain this to people.
Yeah, and that's a nice thing, too. There is a complexity to the characters. They give Robespierre's little bits of business with the dog and the pigeons, as you said, that kind of humanize a very inhuman character. The relationship between Madelon and Charles, where they'd known each other previously, which is another film noir thing, which we get into in Crisscross, where you reunite with an old love.
Exactly, yeah.
They don't take it in the same way they do in Crisscross, but it does shortcut, for plot purposes, that getting to know you kind of stuff between the romantic leads. Because they had the previous history, they can hook up again, and you don't have to spend time with them holding hands, walking through parks, and all that other thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. And what I really found amazing... Oh, sorry, yeah.
No, please, what were we going to say?
What I really found amazing in this movie is, for me, the core tense element is that during the movie... One element I really also like is that the main good guy is also a badass, actually, because you basically introduce him after the riding scene and meeting the Marquis de Lafayette and getting basically his assignment, is that he basically is either himself killing this guy who is imposing, or is helping killing him, because you just see an arm with a dagger. Basically, it could be himself or one of his helpers, but I interpret that he himself killed this guy. So he's basically also not just purely a good guy, he's more like a secret agent guy. So really gives him a toughness and gives him some more interesting layer than just because they could have decided to just take the guy and take him out, but basically handcuff him or like not killing him, right? So, but maybe it's also the times, right? So tens of thousands of people are dying like in a really short period of time. So one more is not that bad.
Yeah, and the social change is so extreme. I mean, I'll just pause here and we'll play a little bit of Robespierre, where he explains the degree of social change in France at the time.
I demand death for the enemies of France. I denounce Danton. I demand death for Danton. I demand the right to be heard.
I am assassin.
You stand accused, guilty, condemned.
Who accuses me?
I, Robespierre.
Dictator!
Silence! Your trial is over.
It hasn't begun.
Citizens! What is your will?
To plead for your husband's life, you're late.
Maximilian, what has come over you? Danton is your friend, your very good friend. Together you saved France. Without Danton, where would you be today?
I can't let personal feelings interfere. The people have found him guilty.
The people, but you are the people. They do what you say.
Take out an appeal.
Who can I appeal to? Only you. Look at me. Answer me. Stop playing God.
God? The revolution abolished God. It's only the will of the people. And the people have spoken.
And Robert Cummings, interesting actor too. I've seen him in a couple of things. He did a Twilight Zone episode as a dramatic role. He was very, very good in that in the early 1960s. And in this he plays tough as well. But for the most part, his career was kind of light leading man roles. There was some TV series, The Robert Cummings Show and My Living Doll with Julie Newmar, where he was doing slightly effeminate kind of light leading man comedy roles, but he did have the chops to do dramatic acting as well. And unfortunately, because of the way people get pigeonholed in Hollywood, he really didn't get the opportunity to show his dramatic acting chops very much.
Yes, does a bang up job, I think. And I really like the main topic of tenseness in this movie, that basically, he's this character where the whole movie, his identity is questioned, and then many people really directly tell him, oh, I think you're not the guy you're supposed to be because you're not looking like a murderer or blah, blah, blah. So it's almost a Hitchcock-like quality, I think, in this movie, where you have this amazing tense scene where they are just barely escaping prison by this other woman playing his wife, and then you have this possibly 90-year-old prison guard who is fumbling for the keys. And to not just find the proper key. That's such a great scene. And you see his face, sweat dripping down. So it's really, it's amazing. So you're really on the edge of your seat, even with this kind of old movie. It's really great filmmaking.
Yeah, and there are a couple of other really tense scenes as well. There's the one where they meet the guys who are guarding the road. One of them played by Dabs Greer, who we know from a lot of westerns, playing a kind of French revolutionary, which is very much driving his kind of stuff, where they were negotiating. They told him that they were farmers, and he was negotiating whether they could get him a couple of chickens for him and his mate who were guarding the road. So there's that tension there where they could have been caught out. And there's the bit with the book as well underneath the pillow where they get the black book and hide out in the farmhouse.
Fabulous.
And the tension there is fantastic, where they're hiding out with a grandmother and a couple of kids, and the Robespierre's guards come in and almost get the book about three or four times in the one scene. And they do finally get the book.
I really love grandmother. She plays so
Bondi,
well.
Yeah, a great actor, and she her playing it is perfectly pitched. It's there's the fear for her family as well as her fear for her country, and the boldness she has in hiding this stuff from the guards is really great. I mean, it's one of those kind of older lady roles where she only has really one scene, but she does it brilliantly well, and it just lifts the movie again.
And I like her cursing when she's stoking the fire, when she's a filthy swine. What did he say? More wine? It's really amazing. I love the scene where Weston just tries to interrogate the little boy and says, do you want to be a soldier? Do you want to have a horse and a gun and a sword, you know? And you first notice, oh, shit, this guy is talking, the little boy. So they think, what a shit heel that he uses the child to get his information. And then the cat licks at his booth, and he just kicks the cat around. And this is, of course, possibly the most horrible thing you can do as a bad guy, to hurt either children or animals. And you have both in one scene. And then the boy runs over and says, no, I didn't see anybody. Like, basically, fuck you.
Don't
tell you anything.
Yeah, that's great. And that's it. There are the emotions of about three or four different characters playing in that scene. And it's brilliantly done, and I think Anthony Mann did a fantastic job. There are a couple of scenes, too, of people racing across the countryside on horses, which shows a lot of the same stuff that Anthony Mann brought to it, the westerns he did later on. There are moments that feel like a western almost, with the good guys being chased by the bad guys across the countryside, all of which was generic Californian countryside. it could almost, because it was at nighttime too, it could almost have been a western. Like, is this the same movie or is it not? But allowing for that, it works really well. And the fact that they had these actors with these beautifully resonant voices and who could play larger than life characters really well. Fouché, played by Arnold Moss. Basehart, of course, was a New York stage actor. Norman Lloyd had been on the New York stage. Norman Lloyd's still acting. He's like 99 or something like that, and he's still around. Wow, talking about his time with Orson Welles and people like that. I mean, he's still got a pulse and he's still got all of his faculties. This is just a great little film, a nice tense drama. Apparently the sets only cost $40,000 to put together because they rejigged the old ones from Joan of Arc, and the movie's budget itself wasn't enormously large. But it's a good, honest little thrill. What were you going to say?
I read somewhere that for many of the noir movies, especially the ones made still during the Second World War, that the sparsity of the sets really is basically mostly based on the cost reduction and stuff. And I actually read a funny trivia. I bought a noir introductory book a couple of days ago, and it's really a nice book. But they, of course, try to report a bit behind-the-scenes stuff from many of the great noirs. Like, for instance, my absolute favorite would possibly be Double Indemnity by Billy Wilder. But there's a scene when Walter Neff, or the main actor, meets Barbara Stanwyck in the store where you have all these cans and everything. And this, of course, during the Second World War, it looks a bit sparse, but still there's a lot of real stuff standing around, like fruit and but all in cans, milk and everything. And I read one of the trivia was that they had to have security guards on set because they used real stuff, not props, but real boxes of peaches and everything. But still, like four cans of peaches were stolen during the scene or from the set because it was wartime and everything. So I thought this great.
But, But this one, there's a torture scene in it that gets very tense as well for a film made in the 1940s as well, where Madelon gets tortured by Robespierre and his mates. I mean, Robespierre's headquarters is really interesting too. They've got a bakery at the top end, a boulangerie, and then underneath that they've got Robespierre's offices, and underneath that they've got a torture chamber. It's a weird...
Yeah, it's kind of, without going too deep or going too arty-farty, but it seems to be a bit reflecting the layered nature of the film, that you have this layered couple of chambers beneath each other.
Yeah.
And actually, I really like also the idea that you have quite graphic violence. They have, in this movie, you have basically two headshots. There's one robber in the beginning, or one assassin, one of the assassins shot in the face, and there's in the end, of course, without spoiling, but there's another famous headshot. And who does not even lead to dying, which is also for the time, I guess, because usually at the time, I would say, when people get shot, they die immediately without pain, and they're just dead, like in a Western, when Indians are shot, they just fall from the horse and they're gone, right? But in this case, you have a little bit of a different scene, which I liked a lot.
Yeah, I'm not sure they had the high velocity rounds at that stage anyway, and maybe they were trying to be a little true to the kind of weapons they had at the time. But yeah, it's an interesting crossover, that kind of film noir sensibility coming into a French revolutionary movie. I mean, it's much better than the recent version of Les Mis, which I only saw part of. Les Mis, right? Yeah, well, that's it. And you know, I saw the version of it with Jean Gabin in it. I thought, no, it just doesn't play anymore. Yeah,
most recent one, and they hated me for it, I guess.
I don't like the music. I think the music is heavy and a bit dull. I've heard the whole soundtrack of Les Mis, and it just doesn't play well for me. But I think that's about all we've got for Reign of Terror. I will post on paleo-cinema.blogspot.com the link to the full movie, so people can watch it in its entirety on YouTube. And it's a pretty good print too. I've looked through the print on YouTube, and it's definitely very watchable. And the movie's not particularly long, but it's a good, honest film that kind of crosses genres. Anything else you want to say about it?
Yeah, I have to say what I liked about the movie was also that it also inspired me a bit to look into real history about the time, which was really interesting. I also always I had history in school, and it's one of the main courses, and I really love these periods of political turmoil where one older society is kind of thrown to pieces and a new society comes up, but it's still not yet fully established. And actually... this Reign of Terror, which I afterwards only fully understand, was a real thing and not just something they made up for a movie, but just a period of about, I guess, 7 months, where basically really tens of thousands were put to the guillotine, and this Committee of Public Safety, which was headed by Robespierre, was really found to suppress the counter-revolutionary activities. And but in the end, the revolution really ate her children, so to say, also the main guys like Robespierre and Saint-Just were really beheaded. Actually, I wasn't really sure if he planned to make himself a dictator or something, so I guess for the movie, of course, as usual, they overdid it a bit, but still fully justifiable. So I guess it's a great interest, not great, but an interesting time in French history, and quite complicated. But interesting.
Yeah, I don't think I did a quick read through as well on the revolutionary history, and I don't think Robespierre was as bad as Richard Basehart was.
Exactly.
And he died a couple of years after the Reign of Terror, so it wasn't. They've kind of contracted the timelines a little bit, but you can allow that in movies. You've got to have the bad guy getting the chop at the end of the movie.
Absolutely.
In these kind of movies, and it's nice to see Richard Basehart in one of these early roles. He did a couple of really interesting things at the early start of his career, which are definitely worth looking into. Apparently he had a lot of ill health in later life, and so didn't have quite as long a career as a lot of other actors. But he was very good at playing those kind of intense, dislikable characters.
I basically got to know him from Moby Dick, so that was my first introduction to his acting. So,
Call me Ishmael.
Ishmael, yeah.
Yeah, which is another interesting failure as well, John Huston's Moby Dick. I really should do that for a future podcast because it's a beautiful piece of work.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm not sure Gregory Peck was the right person to play Captain Ahab, but I can argue that at the time. Just looking at the woman who played the old lady in Reign of Terror, Beulah Bondi. She lived she lived until the 1980s and did TV series like The Waltons. Played an auntie she lived to be like 91 or something like that, and she was playing old ladies in movies since the 1940s. So there you go. Yeah.
She just had the face, yeah. But she worked with Jimmy Stewart, I guess, also in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and is it a Frank Capra movie, the Christmas movie? It's all American classic. I just forgot the title.
That one. It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life, of course. Yeah. So she played with him at
least. I don't like that for a lot of reasons. I really should do It's a Wonderful Life one day just to say why I don't like it.
Okay. Yeah, we'd love to hear this.
Okay. Yeah, so
I'm also not too big fan of it.
Anyway, we'll stop it there and we'll talk. We'll take another break and then we get back. We'll look at a more traditional film noir, being Crisscross, directed by Robert Siodmak from 1949.
Anna.
Steve, I had to see you.
You'll get wise. The last minute, you'll ruin everything.
I slipped out. He was dancing. Oh, Steve, I keep thinking and thinking.
Will you just not think about it?
I'm so worried about you. I'm all sick inside. Oh, if it was only all over now, if it was only this time tomorrow.
You know what to do? Have you got it right?
Suppose you get hurt.
Remember, you'll go to the cottage at Palos Verdes.
Suppose something goes wrong.
And you'll wait there. It'll take a little time, a few weeks.
Why do you say weeks? Why not days?
Just stay at the house at Palos Verdes. Don't try to get in touch with anyone. Don't do anything until I get there.
I'll hate it. I'll hate it every minute until you're with me again.
You better get back before he starts looking for you.
Steve.
I don't want to see the two of us coming in together. Go on now. Go on.
Steve, all those things that happened to us, everything that went before, we'll forget it. You'll see I'll make you forget it. After it's done. After it's all over and we're safe. It'll be just you and me. You and me. The way it should have been all along from the start. Be careful.
And we're back and we're going to look at one of the early roles by Burt Lancaster, an actor I've talked about in the podcast before, and that is Crisscross, a 1949 film noir starring Burt Lancaster, Yvonne DiCarlo, and Dan Duryea. Music was by Miklos Rocha, but it's not very distinguished, and it was directed by Robert Siodmak, a director who did a number of really good films noir in his time. But yeah, Dan Duryea as well. Dan Duryea kind of played these kind of gangstery roles a lot in films noir. But the thing I really showed me how good an actor Dan Duryea was, that there's an episode of Route 66 he does, which is set in Florida, where he plays an alcoholic father trying to regain custody
of his daughter.
And Dan Duryea, in an episodic TV show from the 1960s, gives an Academy Award-winning performance. He really does do a fantastic job in that role, and it's kind of made me reevaluate his earlier work. And I'll try to find the name of the episode. But anyway, just tell me a little bit while I'm looking that up. Tell me a little bit about what brought you to this film.
Yeah. Actually, I saw it first on television, as many of these movies when I was more or less growing up, and always was fascinated by the kind of storytelling and by the apparent character flaws of the main hero and the difference of his physicality to his apparent psychological weakness or the obsession towards the Yvonne DiCarlo character, and of course also the not obviously totally happy ending. So I guess that's not a major spoiler for film noir, but that always drew me in and really kept me fascinating, and therefore Of course, I'm like Zom. I'm a real, real large Burt Lancaster fan. Early, middle, and later work, also the versatility of his work. So that's just for me all win, so to say. There's nothing bad about it.
And Lancaster too. I mean, for all his flaws as a human being, he was He's one of those guys, and you, as you look through the history of film, he's one of those guys that's more intelligent than he lets on, a bit like Robert Mitchum, where Mitchum was highly intelligent but always underplayed it and didn't make a brag about it. And you can tell that because of the way they approach the material. I mean, they read a script. Sometimes they're contractually obligated to do it. But they understand the character instinctively and bring parts of themselves to it. And I think that Lancaster does that in this. I mean, there are bits of it where they, like you said when we recorded earlier, they emphasize the physicality of Lancaster. Yeah. I mean, running up staircases and things like that when he's up at Bunker Hill and runs up the staircase and pats the dog and things like that. Yeah. There's always a joyousness to the physicality that Lancaster has. And
you know, talking about the dog, sorry if I interrupt, but thinking about the scene, underlines, I think, the thing that he comes over a bit, as a little child coming home, not from a month-long tour across the country, but just coming home from playing and petting this dog, is sitting on the porch, is really coming over a bit like a child, as his character appears later on in the movie when his mother and his friend talk to him and try to get him out of this obsession and everything. So it's really already foreshadowing a bit about his apparent character flaws or problems and his reaction to things. So that's kind of all plays nicely into each other.
Yeah, it very much does. And also the fact that he suddenly embedded back in the extended family, his brother's engaged and he's going to get married at some stage, his mother's there as well. It kind of does infantilize him a little bit and then show that he's really his own worst enemy when it comes to his judgment. His best friend, a cop called Ramirez, played by Stephen McNally, basically warned off his ex-wife and threatened to throw her in prison if she didn't back off, which may or may not have been legal, but he would have found some kind of trumped-up charge to get her on because he knows that she's bad for his friend. And they are quite close friends in a lot of ways. But that kind of thing where everybody except Steve knows that Anna is bad for him, including Dan Duryea's character, who's married to her. It's a really interesting thing where his focus on what he perceives as love, which is probably something else, like some kind of erotic fixation almost.
Exactly.
Is the downfall of the guy eventually. So he helps in order to misdirect Slim away from thinking that he and Anna have restarted their relationship. He arranges a bank robbery of his armored car, because he works as an armored car driver, to try to kind of just almost, he doesn't really care about the money that much. He just wants to distract attention away from the fact that he's nailing this guy's wife, who used to be his wife.
Yes.
And they get in this guy called Finchley, played by Alan Napier, who played Alfred in the Batman TV series. And he is brilliant in this role. You know, a scholarly English gentleman who is a criminal mastermind.
And I like that he's paid in booze, basically. So they pay 1 month of his liquor for at the store to pay him off, not just money. So, but he doesn't drink while working, so that's amazing.
Yeah, he does. Awesome. And like I said before, he's very much like Sam Jaffe in Asheville Jungle. He's a criminal mastermind who comes in almost like a subject matter expert, who's brilliant at what he does and helps them organize the thing. He organizes the smoke bombs that they're going to use to cover the robbery. He organizes the truck. An ice cream truck's going to be used to take the money away because it's not a fast vehicle and it won't draw attention to itself with the police.
Yeah.
There are all these meticulous little bits of business there, which are really great. And it shows that other thing we mentioned, which is how every character actor in the movie gets a moment to shine.
Yeah, and to be honest, I love these planning scenes that you often have in these noir or other crime movies focusing on a heist. We have people sitting around a table smoking, and the night passes while they're discussing everything. And that's just for me a great tense moment, an interesting moment also showing character and just of course you know it will be harmed in the end, it will go wrong, but you never know at what point of the story what goes exactly wrong. Is it human error, or is it like an accidental thing, or is it like, for me, the greatest moment ever of something going wrong is possibly in the killing, when the dog runs over the runway and the suitcases fall off the transporter and the money blows in the wind.
It's amazing stuff. And you know, there are so many good little character actors in this. There's Richard Long playing Steve's brother, who people knew from The Big Valiant, Nanny the Professor in the 1960s. You got John Doucette playing one of the criminals in there. You got Percy Heldon playing the barman, who thinks when Steve first comes in that he's actually from the Liquor Commission and is checking up on them, and then finds out that he isn't. Yeah. So there's a little bit of business with them. And there's the drunk lady who sits at the end of the bar, who's really interesting character.
Joan Miller, right? Is it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Joan Miller.
She's just called the Lush.
Yeah, the Lush, which is kind of a... Yeah, a bit dismissive there, but and then they've got that great dance sequence where Steve meets Anna again, where she's dancing with, and you can announce this one,
Tony Curtis, uncredited,
and they've got the beautiful cross cutting between her face, his face, Burt Lancaster's face, and the rumba band they're dancing to. The cross cutting between all three of them beautifully, which, as I said when we recorded this previously, parallels the jazz scene in Phantom Lady, which was also directed by Seod Mac, which with Elisha Cook Jr. in it. That jazz scene there's a quick cross cutting, using music as a way of ramping up the tension in the film, and that's been used by a number of other people since then. But it's beautifully done here, I think, and it's one of those things that unless you're really looking for it, it doesn't draw attention to itself, but it does emphasize how interesting and how Seod Mac thought his way through a lot of this stuff.
And I guess you cannot get more sexual in a movie of that era with a Hays Code and everything without really being blown out. I mean, that's just really... I mean, you have the movement, the mood, the music, and I love all the small details. Also, when you watch at the piano player, he makes these nice mouth movements when playing. He's really into it. That's really all the flute player. It's really so much energy in there.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that in a lot of films noir, they would have gone with something like a jazz score, but instead they did a rumba score, which was very kind of popular at the time, but it's them thinking outside of the box again, like we were talking about in Reign of Terror, thinking outside the box when you're making these films. And it wasn't an A picture particularly, it was more a B picture at the time because this is just before Lancaster peaked. And the people involved took such meticulous care and really thought things through, which I really like. I mean, it's one of those joys in movies, just seeing the tender, loving care they give, even minor scenes in the film.
Yeah, that's true. It's so important because there's also the stuff that you attend to when you watch a movie the second or third time, and it really grows in the overall value of the piece of art. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, and I might have said this on the podcast before, but every movie is successful because everybody involved with it made a movie. They got together all the people they needed to do and all of the everything they needed to do, and they made a film. So at one level of achievement, every movie is successful. And this movie only needed to make a little bit of money. It wasn't meant to be a blockbuster. It wasn't meant to be an Academy Award winner or anything like that. But 70 years, almost 70 years later, we're still talking about it. And there are these little bits of business where people did take that extra care that make it memorable. And that's a joyous thing, and that's such a gift to give people. They didn't know they were doing it. They didn't even know they were making film noir, because that came, about 8 or 10 years later, when the Cahiers de Cinema guys in Paris created the concept of film noir. These people were just making a good, honest little crime film. But they did it so incredibly well.
And I think also it's interesting that these totally different types of movies have so different basically scopes. The one we discussed before, Reign of Terror, is really actually a quite large-scale story about the future of a nation, basically, and thousands of people. This is basically about two people or three people in the center of the story, and it's basically a story about sexual and psychological obsession and the doom that comes with it, and the lady with the past and the hero with no future. So that, but still, it's highly entertaining and interesting, and really keeps you involved. And it's also a timeless thing, basically. Yeah.
And the robbery itself is interesting too. I mean, you look at something like Reservoir Dogs. Tarantino never shows the robbery in Reservoir Dogs, but mm-hmm. because of budgetary limitations. But in this one, you see the guys stacking the money in the mail in the bank bags, and talking about how their wives waste 25 cents when they're buying things by calling the supermarket to deliver things rather than going to the supermarket themselves. And they're treating all these bricks of money that they're putting into the bags like they're house bricks or something that they're stacking. Yeah. And that's a beautiful little bit of business too. I mean, it shows you that these guys are working stiffs. The money doesn't really mean yes. anything to them as money. I mean, it's a job exactly. they've got to do. And then they have that great scene where you see Burt Lancaster and the guys with bags of money slung over their shoulders walking down to the armored car. And it looks a lot like a studio set. But then as he gets into the armored car and the camera pans upwards, you see that it's actually an alleyway that leads onto a real street. And, yes, and that blew me away. That's just a fantastic moment. And it's all done kind of from a high shot. Looking down on it all. And then when they get to the place there to deliver the money to, there's another really great overhead shot of the armored car going into the factory and driving in between the warehouses and things, which shows a really unusual camera angle. And the armored car is a 1940s armored car, so it looks a bit weird to our eyes anyway. And, it's rather than just kind of sticking the camera on a street corner and panning it left as the truck turns
exactly,
around,
yeah.
they've made a choice which is a lot more complicated to do, but really does add visual interest.
In the film noir movie book I just recently bought, which has some beautiful behind the scenes images from many movies, but also from Crisscross. For instance, it shows a scene where Lancaster's in the car, and they basically show a bit the setup of the driving scenes, which are done with rear projection and stuff, but also how the different patterns of lighting are projected through kind of a rotating grid and stuff like that. Yeah. Really nice images helping you to understand the creative process. But the angles, you're fully right about this. Just get my dog switching. Sorry.
Yeah. Hi, Ben.
Yeah.
Settle down.
He's looking.
Okay, fair enough. Good. Yeah, but and Dan Durio again. I've actually found that Route 66 thing. If people want to write down the name of the episode, it's from season 1, episode 24 in 1961. It's called "Don't Count Stars." I'll put a link to the IMDb page for it because it's a surprisingly brilliant bit of acting for just an episodic TV thing. And I kind of like dipping – now and then I'll find them on YouTube, the Route 66 episodes with Martin Milner and George Maharis traveling around America in a Corvette having adventures. And they're kind of cool too, but that's a bit of a distraction from what we're talking about. So there's some rules of film noir we should tell people to observe. Never go back and hook up with your ex-wife.
Yes.
That would be the first one. It's never going to end well. Second one is if all of your friends tell you something, the odds are very strong that they're right and you're wrong. And the third one
especially
is
if
your wife is now ex-wife is now married to a gangster, move across the country. Don't go anywhere near them. Move five or six states away.
Get away.
Provinces, states, whatever you do. In your case, move to England. And in my case, moved to Australia, but or the Northern Territory for that matter, to Darwin.
Yes.
But one way or the other, things are not going to end well. And probably the worst way to misdirect your ex-wife's new husband from the fact that you're having an affair with her is to plan an armored car robbery with her.
Exactly.
With him, yes.
As deadly as directly confronting the husband.
Yeah. And that's the thing that I get from this too, is that Steve doesn't care about the money. He never talks about the money he's going to make from this robbery. It's like he just doesn't care. It's like he knows his fate in a sense. Or the other possibility is he did decide to betray them during the armored car robbery to get Slim Dundee out of the way by getting him caught.
Yes.
During the robbery. So that may have been the other reason for it. But one way or the other, he never mentions the money. And that would have said, if I was Slim, that would have sent off a few alarms. Yeah, this guy wants to plan an armed robbery with us, but doesn't care about money. Why is, what's his motive?
That's weird, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't think we talked about this before, but we, of course, mentioned the influence of all the European directors coming over to the US and making these beautiful movies. But also, I think it's interesting the kind of increase in interest in psychoanalysis, which is also reflected sometimes in these movies, like the obsession of the main character you have here, or in, later also in Vertigo by Hitchcock. So this is a core element of the doom that you cannot escape because it's in your brain, it's in your head. So it's not just the influence of the whole surround or other people on you, but yep. It's something in your imprint, in your cognitive setup that really drives you to certain things.
There was a murder case in Australia where, very recently, and I was reading about it in the newspaper, to track his ex-wife, a guy put a GPS tracker on her car so he knew where she was at any particular time. And that's exactly this kind of obsession, this detail of obsession. It's that control thing, and yeah, I know where you are, and I can get you when I need you, kind of thing. In that particular murder case, but it shows that in the real world there is that level of obsession that people do have if they don't get help and if they don't understand what's happening. And that's of course why these movies are so strong, because at some level we can relate it to something we've seen somebody do or something we've done. And most people have had unsuccessful relationships. And the headspace you get into when a relationship fails can be quite away from reality in some ways.
Yeah, that's maybe the strongest driving force for positive and negative things, way more than money or just financial incentives. Definitely.
Yep, and that's why film noir is such a strong genre and why people keep revisiting it as well. There are so many modern noirs. I mean, and then you've got Scandinavian noir now with all of the girl we played with fire and those kind of things. Yes. Scandi noir, and of course, a lot of this in the 60s, there was crimi movies in Germany. All of those, Edgar Wallace-based things and the Jerry Cotton stuff and all the rest of it and all the things with Gerd Froebel in it. And Dr. Mabuse and all that kind of thing. Yeah, and we talked...
Klaus Kinski.
Klaus Kinski, definitely Klaus Kinski, yeah. And, so basically we were talking, too, about Anthony Mann.
Yes.
The director of Reign of Terror, and how his last movie and Siobhan's last movie were both affected by Lawrence Harvey.
Exactly, and The Dandy and Aspic was actually then finished by Harvey after passing of Anthony Mann.
And we've got that's that a film.
Oh, please go ahead. It was your
theory. What I was going to say is Lawrence Harvey kills movie directors.
But he also died very young. Maybe there was a revenge from another unknown movie director. Who knows?
It could have been a 12-year-old Quentin Tarantino. Who knows? But
who knows?
But we also agree that we're going to do Dandy and Aspic for a future podcast as well.
Would be great. It's an interesting thing.
Maybe a Dr. Mabuse movie. We might do the Thousand Eyes of Dr. Mabuse because that's got Klaus Kinski in it.
Oh yeah, please. Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Okay, so we'll lock that in. We'll lock that in as a future one, and you can bring your local sensibilities to that one as well, because I'm sure there are things that I missed those kind of movies that a local person may pick up on. But just to wrap up, Crisscross, it's got a lot of the noir things. It's got the kind of ruthless woman who's only out for herself. You've got the gangster in there. You've got the physically strong but mentally and psychologically weak protagonist. You've got a robbery. You've got interesting secondary characters. It's in black and white. It was made in the 1940s, and it's really good.
Yes, did I miss anything? Absolutely. No, I think you pretty much got everything.
Yep, and the other thing, too, is that we decided that we liked Reign of Terror more than we liked Crisscross by a small margin, because they were thinking outside the box by making an epic French revolutionary movie with film noir cinematography by John Alton.
Yeah, I think the story and the cinematography are both a bit above Christgau's, but he for me has the Lancaster bonus, so therefore they're very close, but with a bit elevation towards Reign of Terror. But both are very advisable, I would say. So.
And they're a good combination. You did really well by picking these two movies back-to-back because they've got that same cinematography thing. They're pretty much contemporary films of each other, but they're also very different movies. And the fact that they both sit comfortably within that genre is just shows you the fact that it's a genre that does have a lot of legs. And we're going to continue to see neo-noir movies in the future because of that strength that the types of characters you get in film noir and the types of plot lines are things that are universal. You can do them as westerns. I'm sure there are a few noir westerns. You can move it to any location and it'll stay true to itself.
Actually, I'm the newest film project I have is to delve a bit more into the more recent Spanish movie output, and I guess there's actually a couple of movies which you could call Spanish noirs, Spanish neo-noirs. There's one I recently bought called El Cuerpo, The Body, which from the trailer looks extremely like a noir, but just in playing in the post-2000s, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
The only Spanish thing I've seen lately that I really enjoyed was The Skin I Live In, a Modovar's movie with Antonio Banderas.
Yes.
That thing is a mindfuck of a movie. It really is.
Not good things
it
about
definitely
it.
Messes your head around. I think what I might do is I'm getting my friends Grant and Sonia to do Splice, the movie by Vincenzo Natali. I think The Skin I Live In would go well with Splice. So I might do that.
Nice combination. Yeah.
But anyway, thank you for letting me call you back so we could get the second movie done.
No problem.
I really appreciate that, mate. And you and I will work out when we're going to do a Danny and Aspic and the Thousand Eyes of Dr. Mabuza. And I think we'll have a bit of fun, and it's been a great joy for me to have a chat with you about these films.
Pleasure was all mine, Harry. Thanks so much, and have a great night over there, and hope recording worked out this time.
And the recording did go well, so I'd like to thank Armin for his invaluable assistance and for bringing the two movies to Paleo Cinema Podcast. That's it for this time around. I'll be back in 2 weeks and I'll do some feedback then. But in the meantime, enjoy yourselves. Keep watching movies.